Wake up.
I don't want to wake up.
The following program deals with controversial subjects. The theories expressed are not the only possible interpretation. The viewer is invited to make a judgment based on all available information.
Let's go. Like this.
Only a dream.
I think, therefore I am.
Joss Book.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Joss
Book. Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Joss
Book.
Let there be light.
Wake up.
Yes, Joss
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States. It read, when certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Joss Book.
In the public mind, label them
Joss Book.
Fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them fact. After enough repetition, in the public mind.
Luke Notaras. Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras. N-O-T-A-R-A-S.
Hey, everybody. Right Perspective Radio. This is Chapter 7 of Destiny of the Mind, and this is Das Buch with David Slurman and Luke Notaras. So here we are with Chapter 7, Destiny of the Mind. How are you, Luke?
I'm doing well, Davis. How about you?
Better than I deserve. How's that sound?
Yeah, you sound a lot better.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The throat is better. Now the back is bad for some reason. Revenge of something from a long time ago, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just, you know, slept wrong. That's really weird when you wake up all, you're well rested and then you move wrong and go, oh. Anyway. Yeah,
that's all it takes.
Neither here nor there.
I've had that sometimes too, like when I'm taking a shower and then I just reach up to wash my hair and then I'm, oh, something snapped and I'm not the same for the rest of the week.
Yeah, it's really weird. My goodness me. All right. So, I believe you had an introductory video regarding pronunciation of ancient Greek philosophers.
Yeah, I came across this when I was looking on YouTube for pronunciations of names that I was unfamiliar with. And this guy did a pretty funny video where he plays an ancient Greek and a modern Greek and himself in the Anglosphere giving different pronunciations of Greek philosopher names. And because I tried to, in the past, the sessions that we've done so far, I've kind of half and halved it. I've anglicized some and then tried to get close to the original pronunciation with the others. So for consistency's sake, I'm going to keep doing that half and half thing. But nice. this gave me a chuckle, so I figured we could watch it. It's like 4 minutes or so.
Excellent. Okay, yes, it's on the screen, and away we go.
Hi, I'm James Harbeck. Yeah. Today's pronunciation tip is ancient Greek philosophers. Now, it just happens that English has developed standards for pronouncing classical Greek that have very, very, very little to do with the way classical Greek was actually pronounced. And we have versions of the names of ancient Greeks that also are quite different from what they were. So I'm going to give the modern English versions, but I'm going to be helped with my friends Demetrios, who's going to give the classical Greek pronunciation, and Dimitri, who is going to give the way it would be said in modern Greek pronunciation. So. Anaxagoras. 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 Anaximandros. Anaximandros. Anaximander. Antisthenes. 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 Arcesilaus. 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 Aristippos. Aristippos. Aristippus. Aristoteles. Aristotle. Chrysippus. Chrysippus. Cleanthes. Democritus. Diogenes. Diogenes. Empedocles. Empedocles. Epicurus. Epicurus. Euclides. Euclid.
Euclid.
Heraclitus. Heraclitus. Leucippos. Leucippus. Parmenides. Platon. Plato.
Plato.
Protagoras. Protagoras. Pyrrhon. Pyrrha. Pythagoras. Pythagoras. Socrates.
Socrates.
Thales. Thales. Xenophanes. Xenophanes. Zeno.
Ineana paradoxo.
And that is how the names are supposed to be pronounced for modern English speakers, and how they are thought to have been pronounced in classical Greek, and how a modern Greek would say them. Thank you, gentlemen.
Ah. Well, you're doing pretty good then, actually.
Yeah. I'm still going to say Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, though. So dude, Greeks will just have to stay mad.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, stay mad.
Right.
It's just if you want to speak to people, they have to know what you're talking about. So there's that upside to the mispronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was fun because a lot of those names have already come up in Haas's book so far, and they're going to come up again in this chapter. So.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Well, again, you've been, I mean, what you were saying sounded pretty good. So I'm going to assume you're more on track than anyone else and as on track as anyone else living, except for perhaps this professor of some sort. I mean, he seems quite learned in the languages. And these are apparently like dead languages at this point, except for folks like this who are persnickety about the actual pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was ancient Greek, which is totally different from like Koine Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was evinced in that video. It seems like a modern Greek speaker would pronounce certain things totally different, but, it is cool to know. And there's a lot of people who get autistic about it. And, like that guy said, this is how it's thought to have been pronounced. So they don't even really know. They're just kind of assuming based on their study that that's what it would have been like in the time of these characters.
It's probably pretty spot on. I mean, when they triangulate what something would have sounded like phonetically, it's generally based on an extremely wide variety of everything from a Rosetta Stone for Greek to a comparison of the living languages and how they evolved, and then you sort of reverse engineer it and maybe amplify those aspects that have passed, you know, this kind of thing. So it's generally based on, I tend to trust the scholars when it comes to that.
Oh yeah. And that was actually Revelo P. Oliver's field of study is philology, the study of language. So he started with Sanskrit. And I think by the time of his death, he fluently spoke, read, and wrote like 17 different languages.
Isn't that interesting? Because as soon as you said the actual field of study, individuals like Noam Chomsky are known as, well, he's a linguist professor who, of course, had some coursework in politics, obviously. So why is it no longer called that? Is there something about the types of language Revelo P. Oliver was studying?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know what the distinction between philology and linguistics would be, other than maybe like the specificity of the application of the language. I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's worth looking up.
Yes, it sure is. All right. Well, and at some point we'll check that out. Oh, I wanted to mention we'll be visiting the chat and the donations of support at the top of each hour. However, Alex Waslak has beat us to it. So we'll be saying hey to him real quick right now.
Yeah. Alex.
Still is locked.
Alex. Laswak.
Alex.
Alex.
Laswak.
Laswak.
Alex.
Alex.
Laswak.
Alex.
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 Laswak.
Alex.
Do we have the correct pronunciation of your name?
Alex.
Still is locked.
Laswak.
Rogue.
There you go. So he got it in right at the beginning, and it was for $11.11. I'm certain there's significance to that. And, all right.
Yeah, Luke. Aren't you supposed to make a wish when you see 11:11 on the clock? I remember a bunch of chicks in middle school talking about that.
Oh, that's because a movie had come out and someone was doing creepypastas with the 11:11. That's why. Yeah, this gets into the youth culture like that. You remember those girls? Some of those girls went so crazy with the creepypastas and the youth culture urban myths that they were killing each other in the woods for Slender Man or whatever his name was.
Yeah, just for the memes.
Evidently, yeah. Who knows how much of that they believed. So,
Davis, that's got to be the name of our new rock band, Murder for Memes.
Murder for Memes? Oh, I like it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a whole new genre happening. Now we're talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Alex, for the 11:11.
Appreciate yes, indeed. It. Chapter 7, Distinctions in Philosophic Thought. So Haas begins by saying the obvious, that the obvious distinction between Eastern and Western philosophy becomes intensified upon deeper investigation. So what did you discover in this chapter at the outset?
Yes, well, speaking of philosophy, the actual term philosophy is inapplicable to the Eastern mind, only serving to obscure and falsify the spirit of Eastern thought, according to Haas. And there's a quote here from Haas: neither the origin, the purpose, nor the intellectual means and methods are the same in the East as in the West. No universal term exists that is sufficiently suggestive to embrace the approach of both East and West.
Hmm. So he would have to invent a term. And again, consider what he's saying, that no universal term exists that's sufficiently suggestive to embrace the approach of both the East and the West. And this is because they're likely either contrapositive or two sides of the same coin of the mind.
Yes, again, they're opposing. So that's what Haas sets out to prove with this chapter, which is a remarkable chapter. And it's quite long, but... Yeah, I tried to jam-pack as much as I could in, so this should be a fun one.
Well, we're in no rush, and we're going to take it as it comes and go as long as we need to explore this chapter, Chapter 7. So, tell us about the etymology of philosophy.
Yeah, that's something that Haas hints at, saying that this unmistakable point of difference between East and West can be derived from the etymology of philosophy, but he doesn't actually give it, so I had to look it up. And what I found is that philosophy comes from the Greek philosophia, meaning love of knowledge, pursuit of wisdom, systematic investigation. So the prefix philo, meaning loving, and sophia or sophis, meaning knowledge, wisdom, wise, or learned. And circa 1300, again, like influence and inspiration, which are words that we explored the etymology of in the last couple chapters, the word philosophy adopted an even more specific definition as the discipline of dealing in rational speculation or contemplation, directly correlating with natural science at the time, which would have included alchemy and occult knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So now that's interesting, because I'm noting here the discipline of dealing in rational speculation. So rational, but rational is defined by the type of mind that is doing the cogitating, speculating, or contemplating.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's what Haas is trying to point out, is that philosophy can only be applied in principle to the Western mind, mm-hmm. as opposed to the East, which he's going to try to define as something else later on.
Yes, but, I'm sure he's going to give us an approximation of an understanding, since it is so foreign. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best we can hope for.
Well, philosophy, as conceived by the Greeks, their love of wisdom included everything worth knowing, not merely as accumulated material, but organized according to value and significance. Each field of knowledge was assigned a place, categorized by its object and corresponding method of procedure. So philosophy is all-encompassing, relying on metaphysics, which is the first philosophy. And Western philosophy today still follows this principle, although realization has become increasingly difficult. And that's evinced by Haas's descriptions back in Chapter 1 regarding that infinite loop permeating the West's current stage, the fourth stage, he called it.
And this is interesting because, of course, not only, by the way, Haas explains this, the infinite loop puts one in a state of, if not stasis, then regression. It's almost like he's hinting at, I don't know where it's going to go in the book, but it's almost as if he's hinting at these mind perspectives, at least the Western one, certainly requires a completely new approach to understanding knowledge. You know what I mean? If you're using philosophy as the tool to understand the world you live in, and you've come to a point where realizations become increasingly difficult, you're in a pattern of diminishing returns, and that's inviting you to discover a new approach.
Well, Davis, the end of this chapter is going to blow your mind.
Oh, good. I didn't reach that. Okay. So, all right. Good. So it's going to be one of these where minds are thinking alike, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Because Haas specifically refers to Arthur Eddington, the 20th century English astronomer, physicist, mathematician. There's a particular quote from him that Haas focuses on to hammer his point home, and it's amazing. So we'll get there.
Well, speaking of quotes, I'll do the Haas quote below. The main characteristic resulting from this idea is the deep conviction that all wisdom, from the supreme to the lesser order, is, and it must be, expressible in concepts. Wisdom at any level is based on and is contained in conceptual thought, and its existence depends on the clarity of its formulations. Your thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, that conviction that he's referring to, the East does not share. So attempting to establish an immediate contact with the real, capital R, the East discards the multiplicity of objects and the fields of knowledge, ignoring the concept as the vehicle of philosophic thought. Wisdom, in the Eastern mind, is achieved and derived from a communion with the real.
Capital and, R, yeah.
Yes, yeah, and that goes along with the affinity correspondence that Haas outlined in the exit of the Eastern mind from the magic world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So you have a note below about word origins. We always love the etymology portions of this. So tell us about the etymology of essential terms to his understandings thus far, like concept.
Yeah, I decided to look into this because Haas seemed to put an exclamation point on this concept. And I said, well, what does that actually mean etymologically? So concept is from the Latin conceptum, meaning draft, abstract, a thing conceived, past participle stem of concipere, which means to take in and hold or become pregnant. So in the 1550s, concept was defined as a general notion, the immediate object of a thought. And that made me think of Parmenides in chapter 6, when Haas pointed out his quote, thought is its own object, proposing that being and thinking are identical. And if you remember us doing the etymology of object, that's from the Latin objectum, meaning thing put before the mind or sight, or objectus, meaning lying before or opposite. So that kind of helps clarify what Haas means by concept, this general notion, the immediate object of a thought.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, almost describing it in, I dare say, personified terms. And ideas are like that. Concepts are like that. You can become pregnant with a concept and it can grow into its own thing. It's pretty interesting word origins, considering the use of the term concept.
Well, yeah, and it's also like a light bulb moment because Haas is saying concept as the vehicle of philosophic thought isn't important to the East. So this relation between concept and object really hammers that home, I think.
Well, at this point in the conversation, I'm sure people are, they're probably getting a sense of it rather than an understanding. Trying to understand, think about this. You are trying to understand what the Eastern mind is like when they, get this, have no meaning for the word concept. They don't use that word. They have no ordered philosophy to understand their knowledge in which the term concept is essential. It's so foreign. It seems that's the sense I bet everyone's getting. Like, wow, that just must be so foreign.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alien.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's the term that Haas uses later on when he gets more specific with the distinctions between the East and West.
It's wild.
Yes. Yeah. It gets really good when he brings up opposites versus polarity. So there's a lot to say there.
Ah, okay. Well, so Haas is unconcerned with the love of wisdom in the Western sense. He's outlining, I should say, unconcerned with the love of wisdom in the Western sense. The East instead focuses their love of reality or essence. Ah, so substitute concept for essence. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, Haas coins another neologism like he did with inburst in chapter 6 to describe the Eastern desire. And he calls it philousia from the Greek prefix philo, meaning loving, and ousia, meaning love of essence. So again, Haas determines to consider philosophy and philousia as opposed to one another, contrasting West and East.
Mm-hmm. And I like that because I have a Western mind and I see the resonance between the two. And you can imagine a tension between these two, although even my Western mind is doing the thing where it considers them oppositional sides of a coin. But I think we're going to learn that's wrong. I think we're going to learn that it's so foreign. It's not so simple. It's so alien. It's not so simple as to say, well, they're just opposite sides of the same coin. It's like, no, I think these might be opposite sides for sure, but of different coins. We'll see. Yeah. So because of their ability to bypass whatever stood in the way of an immediate relation to the real, capital R, the East succeeded in spiritual pursuits culminating with an established fulfillment evidenced in its earliest creations. Help us understand.
Yeah, well, it's kind of going along with what Haas was saying in the last chapter, where if you have things figured out and it ain't broke, don't fix it. So the very beginning of Eastern civilization, their established philosophy, which would be Felugia, Taoism, Confucianism, even the Hindu traditions with the Upanishads, which we get more into later on. Basically, they stagnated almost as soon as they were established because it was satisfactory enough. So all subsequent divergent conceptions were depreciated by this fulfillment, the confluence with the real, because it appears superfluous or even paradoxical. And I took note that this makes sense, because if you already won by beelining to the finish, achieving oneness or communion through affinity and correspondence with all that exists, any added deliberation or scrutiny is not only unnecessary, but could be detrimental.
Oh, sure. And that describes the West, in fact. The West, even if they had the perfect system of understanding that explained all the metaphysical and the physical, they would still endlessly remain in the loop of stasis, where they'd be creating new isms to describe the thing that's already perfect.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is exactly right. And it hurts, but it's true.
Right. Yeah, it's better to know, because you'll likely find yourself doing this. Yeah, in fact, we do this. Yes, I know we do this.
Yes.
So back to the Western consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Haas mentions RK again. Evolved through unique conception of creativity within the Greek philosophic mind, acting as the dynamic principle of creation, evolution, and organization. Because of an ever-increasing escalation of approaches to RK principle and the problems it posed, Greeks began to define the spheres of human experience with more and more clarity, splitting off semi-independent fields of study from the broader sciences. And I took note here just to praise Haas, because I was really enjoying this. The West objectifying things, experiencing wonder as a catalyst to inquiry, embodying unity and variety as a structural principle. All these established ideas that Haas outlined so far make it easier to understand new additions to his conception. And it's clear that he wants us to truly learn, as opposed to just solipsistically flexing his sagacity or erudition. Instead of throwing a bunch of unconnected chapters together that can be read in any order, like a lot of other books, Haas seemingly intended for this work to resemble an actual linear course. Him being a professor probably helped, but this is truly a gem of a book. So I just had to say that.
Yes, no, this is a book that deserves to be appreciated.
Yes. Yeah, it's great.
And it's very dense, which is why we like taking this chapter by chapter.
Yeah.
No reason to rush. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So moving on from that established conception.
Oh, yes. Philosophy, in a narrower sense, unfolded in metaphysics, logic, psychology. Sciences like physics, biology, and medicine, and the humanities, history and political science, were ever ready to draw from the leading ideas of metaphysics, even when established in their own right. So this is more of the looping endlessly in stasis.
Yeah, it's pretty much like what you just said. Right before that aside, ever iterating, ever anew, but also not forgetting the precedence of things already known. So even when we fully understand a concept, instead of just accepting it as is, it engenders more questions, more avenues for us to traverse in search of more knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So now you're about to get into the apotheosis of philosophy.
Yeah.
Boy, now that's a tall order, but do tell us more.
Yes. So according to Haas, The apotheosis of philosophy as the all-embracing doctrine of human knowledge was the system of Aristotle, which would be deductive logic, inductive analysis, natural law, teleology, virtue ethics. Only mathematics developed in its own right, but still under the jurisdiction of philosophy as a pillar of metaphysics, with the contributions from Pythagoras and Plato. And this was a conception unparalleled in the East, according to Haas.
Now, wait a second. A conception unparalleled in the East. You mean that there was no apotheosis of philosophy in the East, or does he mean more specifically mathematics? Because we know there are Eastern peoples who, so far as many understand it, invented mathematics.
Yes, that's correct. He's specifically referring to philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I wonder why they didn't... I'm wondering if this is the cart before the horse, since we have an example of a people that did not fold mathematics into their philosophical teachings as one of the pillars, let's say. We have an example of a people who have no philosophy. And so is it that the mathematics developed in its own right and stood alone and still stands alone? Or was it folded into some system of thinking about the world they live in?
We're going to get to that really soon, with regards to the East and why they create things. It's very, very poignant. So we'll get to it.
Right. Yeah, don't let me ruin it.
That's okay.
All right. So pointing to the Middle Ages and Renaissance practice of nature philosophy as represented by, help me with those.
Yeah. Agrippa and Cardanus.
Oh, see, I was going to say it that way. I swear.
Yeah.
Haas remarks the transition from theology to nascent pursuits, averting focus on the humanities toward infinite fields of scientific study.
Yeah, and Haas mentioned these guys before, Agrippa von Nettesheim and Cardano, but I decided to do a little research just to give some backstory on who they were. So Agrippa was a German polymath, most known for his heretical book on occult philosophy that amalgamated Hermeticism, Kabbalah, and Neoplatonism. And Girolamo Cardano was an Italian polymath, most known for his mathematical contributions to the foundations of probability and achievements in algebra. And he also contributed to the invention and development of the combination lock and the cardan shaft with universal joints that's still used in vehicles today. So that's pretty amazing, because these were both Renaissance guys.
Heck yeah. Wow. Well, they don't call them Renaissance men for nothing.
Right.
Yeah, this is very forward-thinking by definition, right? Interesting. Well, broken up under the impact of these ever-new fields unfolding with demonic fertility, the striking difference between earlier and later processes of philosophy lies in the unconditioned independence of the scientific fields that emerged, with varying degrees of interrelation, but without recognition of a supreme authority.
Yeah, so as opposed to synthesizing the sum total of knowledge under the guiding light of a central idea, all of these fields kind of split, but still remained interconnected. And there's a kind of a poetic quote from Haas here, where he says, "In our day, philosophy, the great mother, is weakened by this resolute defection of her offspring. Her genius languishes in proportion to the growth of the science of nature." Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting, because he's basically saying, just like everything else, the subject-object distinction, there's like a split that's always indicative of Western progress, Western evolution.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful statement, yes. So more, it's very poetic, more personification. Yeah. But this is a condition. I mean, this is the human condition of the Western mind, right? Is that we do separate these things out, and instead of having the great mother studied with all her children, we separate out each of her defected offspring, and we make micro studies of every aspect of that.
Yeah.
Looping in stasis while studying each of her offspring, forgetting that they came from something larger that interrelated.
Yeah.
And that's where the wisdom is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hyper-focusing on the extent of those aberrant vagaries, those branches from the main root, instead of remembering where it came from. Although that is still, it's still there as a precedent, but it's just not focused on enough, I think.
Yeah, it's more like the introductory course, and then it's on to the microanalytics of it all for years and years and deep study. Interesting. Yeah, it comes back to the, it was either chapter one or chapter two, the generalist of knowledge, or the person who deals in great specificity when it comes to knowledge, that there's just, within the Western mind, there tend to be two types of habits of mind.
Yeah, and it's almost unavoidable. This ever iterative, ever anew, constant quest, this journey, this discovery, there's only one way where it ends, and Haas will get to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's help it along. Physicists becoming philosophers and evaluating their works in such terms should be no consolation, according to Haas. Why is that?
Yeah. Applying discoveries or inventions from their field of science to problems like free will, the destiny of man, or his place in the universe. Although legitimate and desirable, these efforts cannot compensate for the lack of an independent, spontaneous creativity on the part of philosophy itself. Freedom and universality being the life breath of philosophy.
Hmm.
And Haas gives an example. 150 years ago, this biological theory of evolution entered the realm of philosophy, but it did not produce anything comparable to the great systems which had been created by philosophy in its own right, like all of those aspects of Aristotelianism. So I thought that was a pretty interesting example.
That is. 150 years ago.
Yeah. Well, a little more. I think Haas said 100 years ago when he wrote this book in the 1950s. So,
yes,
more than that. But
right, this is the biological theory of evolution, however, he was specifically mentioning. Yeah, that probably is the right thing. But still, if you were to compare, I don't think there's any question that Aristotelianism is much more impressive and leads to deeper understandings. Let's face it, if you follow Aristotelianism correctly, you have the opportunity for wisdom. I doubt anyone could ever say that about a theory of evolution.
Exactly, yeah. And I think Haas is getting at this. Any branch of science that people study in modernity, they'll use philosophy as maybe like a catalyst or a springboard, and it might guide them along the path of their discovery, almost like hidden. It's just there as an underlying thing. And then at the end, when they get to a conclusion about whatever it is they're studying, they return to philosophy to try to put a crown on it. And he gets more specific with examples of that later on.
Ah, well, that's an interesting, very interesting way to look at it. Almost like you use these philosophical bookends.
Yeah, so Haas says, highly indicative of the Western mind, individual sciences extending into the broader philosophic field constitutes a testimonial to the Greek conception. The spirit of philosophy remains an ever-inspiring force. And this upcoming observation from Haas is really interesting because he ties Aristotle's word into his own thesis. So eminent physicists, biologists, and historians find it necessary to crown their work with philosophical considerations. What Aristotle would describe as, quote, that which is prior in nature is perceived by us as the posterior, like later in time or subsequent.
Yeah.
So since the need for philosophical conclusions comes at the end of a work, whilst also initiating the research, it is both a termination and a hidden incentive for the whole undertaking. Seeing the process of Western thought as a stream makes this easier to understand, sourced from the dynamism of the Greek philosophy conception.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So that which is prior in nature is perceived by us as the posterior. This could be an example where some experiment in contemporary times confirms a postulate of Aristotle, something that seems impossible to predict, and yet it resonated through history, only to become confirmed later in time. So, like the atom, for example, thinking like, oh, we've discovered the atom. Well, not so fast, really, because this exact constituent component parts of all physical matter was already literally described by the great thinkers of the past before they had the instruments to measure it and confirm it.
Well, yeah, and look at later conceptions like heliocentrism, you know. It's a whole other thing. It takes however many 4 centuries to determine that that was correct. So long after the people who came up with it are gone, is it proven?
Yes, yes. Well, and this is why, again, it's just another impressive aspect of philosophy. It really is an incredible system of thought that tries to better understand the world you exist in.
Yes, and only the Western mind has it. So give yourself a pat on the back, Western man.
Well, we've inherited it. Yeah, don't be too impressed with yourself. Yeah, we've inherited it. Now, if everyone would be smart enough to consider it, study it, and use it the way it's supposed to be used, we would all be, we'd be better thinkers, which really is a preferred way to move through the world.
Yes. All it comes down to is just loving knowledge. I mean, stripped down to its most basic etymological root, that's what it means. So that's the simplest way to look at it.
So a dispassionate spirit, disinterested in everything but knowledge itself, became the legacy inherited from philosophy. Tell us more.
Yeah, so growth within the variegated branches of inherited enlightenment, determined by the motive of systematic knowledge for its own sake, was inherent in the state of wonder, possessed by Greece alone in the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. And in the East, scientific knowledge, no less than general knowledge, grew out of the interaction between natural curiosity and the drive of needs and desires. So, of course, these motivations were also present and active in the West, but philosophy effectively superseded them.
Early achievements in mathematics from India stagnated almost right away, along with Chinese inventions, lacking the original impetus that leads from the universal to the particular and gives a significance to such discoveries.
Yeah, and Haas gives a few examples there, like printing only being used for books, gunpowder used almost exclusively for fireworks, and the compass never leading to an Oriental seafaring people. And this reminded me of this old phrase, necessity is the mother of invention, which I've always argued is the other way around, because I think of Kikes middlemanning the production of some inane trifle and then saying, you need this, with insulting advertisements. So even though the original proverb is derived from Aesop's Fables and Plato's Republic, it seems more applicable to the Oriental mind of Haas's thesis. And applicable also is the consideration of an earlier primitive discovering rudimentary tools by accident, like breaking a stone and cutting themselves before realizing they can cut other stuff with the stone as well. Whereas a Western stream may lead to all sorts of cutting implements and even reasons to cut or other things to cut, The Eastern mind would only consider developing such instruments insofar as their immediate needs required.
Ah, this temporal aspect again, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought this is really cool because he's basically saying what appears to the Western mind as a stagnation because they don't develop things like mathematics further. They achieved what they set out to do because they only developed it because they needed it and desired it for a specific purpose. So the Eastern mind wouldn't see it as a stagnancy. They would see it as a fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's arguable. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yes, given the Eastern mind, sure. Our new understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel possessed by the Western mind, and I want to disagree with it, but yes, with empathy, you can look at how they would see it and say, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Just like he kind of said in the last chapter, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's all I can keep thinking of with the Eastern mind. If I'm just, distilling it to the simplest possible explanation. That's how I view it.
Yeah, so this popular quote going around is, don't tear down fences unless you understand why they were erected.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's good.
The East doesn't need that quote because they would just leave the fence. Leaving the fence is what they do.
Right.
It's only we that need reminding, like, hey, retard, maybe don't engage in destructive capitalism regarding this fence until you fully understand why it was erected.
Well, yeah, and Davis, when you think about all of these inventions and products that you see, I'm sure you've asked yourself at some point, like, who needs this? Who wants this? Who asked for this? Like, what the fuck is this?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's the East producing that, whether it's textiles or manufacturing, because of the Kike middlemanning. So it's completely unnatural, and it's like a super, it's a good example of how Kikes inorganically fucked both sides here.
Oh yeah, they've fully deformed our cultural and economic considerations, and they've deformed certainly the culture, logistics, and to some extent, the economy. Obviously, they're producing these materials. But if you consider what's being done here, it is interesting that you could argue that it's either the West's wanting and desire for new baubles and gadgets, because white people tend to love their frivolities. You could argue that it's our consumptive desires that have made whatever relic of communism still exists in China, have made that something that's reified every day and made more implacable every day as they see the absurd shit they produce for us. They must look at it and raise at least one eyebrow and say, what is wrong with these people, as they ship it out? And that must remind them that they don't want to become like us. Or you could go to the middleman and blame him. But I see our part in this as well.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think back to in State and Society 1 and 2, when Haas was talking about the Eastern mind, the Eastern man, only ever wearing the trappings of these things because they can't fully assimilate it. And their tradition of succession and this affinity correspondence allows them to, just wear the trappings of Western impingement as opposed to fully enculturating it. So I think the opposite, the West doesn't do that. They embrace it wholly. They imbibe it. They embody it.
Oh, it's the new thing. Yes, it's always the latest thing. It's the new thing. It's the novelty engine always running at full tilt.
Yes. Yeah, so I think if the impingement was gone, regardless of who's manipulating that or steering it, which we know is the Jews in this particular case, the East would recover very quickly, I think.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the West, not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We would be like Plato and Aristotle coming up with 75 different versions of government and attempting to implement them, and then always finding some reason why they're not good enough.
Or in the case of, let's say, the Jew middleman disappeared overnight with a button you could push, and suddenly Shenzhen factories would retool for something else, maybe productive capacity of the state or armaments or so, whatever they'd be doing. They'd be doing Chinese things. And as strange as it sounds, I think we would imitate the middleman. We would continue in the pattern. The pattern would hold. There'd be people would step in and play the middleman just to continue production anywhere, somewhere, of the same baubles. The model would stay very much the same until it spun out or reached its absurd conclusion. I'm afraid that would be our fate. Whereas you're right, I think the East would, I think they would rectify things pretty quickly. They also have the benefit of state planning, which I think helps.
Right. But yeah, like you said about the West with that objectification, where they make the distinction of themselves as subject, looking at everything else, observing in isolation. Yeah, they want to share with others. They want to see how other people live, compare it to ourselves to establish our own preeminence, like Haas talked about before. So if that is completely severed and we have no other comparative objects to look at, it'll be much more difficult for us to rectify.
Interesting. So, as you said, even though the Near East and the West are indebted to the East for an indeterminate number of ideas and inventions, judging overall creativity on these lines is inaccurate.
Yeah, there's a quote from Haas here. The important consideration is whether the acceptance of ideas led merely to imitation or whether it stimulated a process of creative assimilation. So that kind of goes along with what we're talking about. Western knowledge stems from the spirit of its philosophy and the impulse born of an attitude implicit in the theoretical questions regarding the universe. Being purely theoretical, unforeseeable results are practically guaranteed. Philosophy at once being the catalyst, the obscured momentum, and the terminus. And contrarily, when not directed toward magic and myth, the East's drive for knowledge remained determined by natural needs, limited in scope by their traditions. So everything connected with such needs also shared their conservative character.
Mm-hmm. That is, limited in scope by their traditions until they met with the cultural and economic deformation of the middleman. Because this business of the way they treat the environment, some would argue that that's very much unlike the Eastern mind. It's very much in violation of their traditions. That's transgressing, and that's violating their laws of tradition. And yet, so this is just one. That's just one aspect of some of the downsides of experiencing the cultural and economic impingement of the Western mind and the middleman kike.
Yeah. Because like you said, those superfluous frivolities, like the bits and baubles that are produced for the West, they wouldn't be destroying the environment if that demand wasn't there. And the demand isn't there in the East, I don't think.
No. They probably have a small order from South Korea every now and then. South Korea being completely under the illusion of democracy and all of this. You know, they're really in the Atlanticist crowd. So there'd still be some, you know, cursed orders from those territories, but I just don't think it'd be the same.
Yeah, because again,
it wouldn't be the same pace of destruction. You know, it's not that they hate the environment, right? They do it because, like, any time it happens in the United States, same thing. It's a practicality. It's like, well, the bean counters say that if we take the risk to poison the lakes, we're only going to get hit with a $158 million fine. But to do it right is going to cost $3.2 billion a year. So, of course, we poison the lake. Well, it's the same bean counting being done under the cultural and economic impingement of the Western Mine and the Kaig over in China. They're counting their beans as well, or in their case, an abacus.
Yeah. Well, and Haas would point out with his distinction, is that merely an imitation or is it an assimilation?
Mm-hmm.
I think with South Korea, like you said, or China, Chinese manufacturing, textiles, Chinese industry, economically, it's all imitation of the West. It's not fully assimilated, even though it seems like it is to our mind, because they could shrug it off in 2 seconds if Jews and the West fucked off, I think.
Oh, yeah. Like this K-pop shit, that's not an enduring musical legacy, please.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Nothing could be a better example of how this would so disappear overnight were it not for the, again, the novelty engine running on full tilt, fueled by the Western mind.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tell us more about the, did you discuss the limitation being the immediate attainment of reality as apart from all other knowledge?
Yeah. We're at the, separator. Oh, okay. For more illustrative comparison of philosophy and philousia now.
Ah, okay. Very good. Very good.
Mm-hmm. So,
philosophy and philousia, again, philousia being a word Haas has created, a neologism, to describe the philosophical, the approximate philosophical equivalent for the Eastern mind. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Love of essence or the real, as opposed to love of knowledge. So laying the foundations of all that merits the name of knowledge in the West, philosophy grows ever more difficult with the increasing independence of branches of knowledge. Compared to philosophy, philousia appears at the same time more pretentious and more modest due to its aim being limited. And that limitation is to the immediate attainment of reality as apart from all other knowledge.
Reality, any capital desire R.
To, yes, capital R. Precluding any desire to trespass upon other territories. So, again, it's this link, this tether that the East maintains after they exited the magic world, this subjectivity.
And Haas... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, you can go ahead. Read the Haas quote.
Okay, yes, the Haas quote. Neither favoring nor actively hostile to either secular or priestly knowledge, philousia pursues its own way with supreme indifference. What's meant by that? Particularly in the indifference part.
Yeah, well, he gives an example by way of block quote from the Chandogya Upanishad, which is a Hindu text. And I'm looking at the time. I know it's close to 9, so we could probably do this after taking a break.
No, yeah, man, that's up to you. I have 8:58, so either okay. Or.
Yeah, because I want to split it up. Since it's a dialogue, we can each pick a character and read it back and forth. I think it'll be fun.
Oh, good. Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Well, here we are, folks, at approaching the top of the hour. And yes, well, 8:59, right? So we may as well get into it. Here we go. Checking over at F to the T to the J. Oh, okay. Who do we have over there? We have a few visitors. That's good news. And let me make sure I have popped out chat for Odyssey. Good, good. Also, Rumble tonight as a backup. Let me make sure that's working. Yes, it is. Good, good. Okay, that's there as a sufficient backup. All right. Where were we? Oh, right. We were going to let the folks in the chat have a hello.
Oh. Right. Well, hey, hello. Welcome to the stream, everybody.
It just never, it never ends. It never ends. It's always something. So how are you guys? Welcome. Who do we have here? We got
MFC NorCal, Serbian Bull, Capto Koshiro, who has nothing to apologize for, Kick Chef, and Creme de la Creme. Nice to see you guys. And?
Guys, yeah. What's going on?
There we go. We have Alex Wazlak, Clasha, Bill 88. And Bushmaster 6A. All right. What's up, guys? Here's what you want to do. Support more of what you want to see in the world. And you do that by supporting donations, super chats, whatever they're calling these super chats today. Just call them donos. There's a couple of ways to do that. And it starts
fuck
with...
Fuck you,
okay,
pay me.
Here we go.
Davis Lerman. Fuck you, pay me.
Jason Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Fucking pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Thanks, Sinead. Okay, so you support what you want to see more of in the world. Otherwise, it goes away. So you got Buy Me a Coffee. We have CoinTree, or it's really cointr.ee. If you have Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Bitcoin Cash, you want to pass along to yours truly. Support Das Buch. We also have Cash App, which folks say is the easiest. And I found something rather surprising out about this. They keep very little. They only keep 2.75%. So that's a good way to go. That's the upside of linking your bank account to Cash App. So that was handy. But you can also use code RPR, Money Tree Publishing. Code RPR. Likewise, we're here on Antelope Hill, antelopehillpublishing.com. All this is in the description, just so you know, for every single show, so you can go to any archive and support later. Where were we? Oh, right. Over at F to the T to the J, Alex Wazak says, no, they're supposed to be Freedom Prize, as referenced yesterday. Yes, I know. Yeah, Alex last night said, couple Freedom Prize for you. That was part of the dono there. Very funny.
Nice.
Freedom Prize. And don't forget Liberty Cabbage instead of Sauerkraut. That was a World War II retardation. Yeah, listen, this country could be so wonderful. And there's a good argument that there were times earlier than today that were much better. But I'm afraid one of the tragedies of the Western mind is this sort of novelty engine sometimes slips into retardation, such as Freedom Fries and Liberty Cabbage. It's inescapable. We should be ashamed forever that anyone ever used the words Freedom Fry and Liberty Cabbage. It's almost homosexual how gay it is. But there we are. All the same, I appreciate the dono for the Freedom Fries, y'all. I'm going to get my Freedom Fries and my next vaccine whenever that's available. Okay. That's a joke. I don't get vaccines, but you know what I mean? Remember that guy? Who was that guy? He was the New York mayor, and he went to like a Smash Burger or something and tried to convince everybody that if you get your vaccine, that you're going to get some free fries. And he was stuffing his mouth with the fries while talking. Do you remember this? Oh, God, but it wasn't Bloomberg. Who the hell was that guy? All right. It don't matter. Here we go. Let's go back to StreamYard. And, oh, yeah, we still have Luke here. Good, good. All right. Thought we might have lost him. Did I mention Buy Me a Coffee? Did I mention Cash App? Sure we did. All right. That's how it works. Let's go back to an image. Oh, she's guilting you. All right. Das Buch continues. What say you, Luke? Luke appears to be muted. All right, let's hope all is okay. Well, let me look at some of the specific chats over at Odyssey. Oh, thank you, de Blasio. My God, it's such a hard name to remember because it turns out his real name was like very German, which is so weird. He turned it into like some Americanized Italian name. I guess that works in New York. He must have been thinking that. Damn French having the balls to say they didn't want to help fuck up a country for no reason. Yes, right. What? We can't use your airspace to go bomb Iraq, wasn't it? Yeah. Yes, the hard-on for Iraq. This country. Well, it's really Jews, I know, but, you know, we're at least half at fault. Let's not take us off the hook by just doing the whole Jews bit. There is a solution to that. You know, one day you have to tell the Jew to go fuck himself, which is certainly an emotionally potent oversimplification, but you know, you see the power in that. I think we should, in this case, we should keep it simple. We don't need to dialogue to consensus on it. In fact, we shouldn't be dialoguing with the Jew about anything. This is how we got where we are. Dialoguing with the Jew. When you dialogue with the Jew, he changes you. You don't change the Jew. Ah, hello, Luke.
Yeah, sorry, I had to run for a second, but I'm back.
No worries, no worries. Excellent. Mm. Okay, we should be picking up now. Tell me my part in this, won't you?
Well, I know you probably want to play the father. But
I'll play whatever. It's fine with me.
I'm going to play the father. You play the son.
Excellent. Okay, so where it says son or S, I'm going to read.
Yes, so giving a little bit of a introductory backstory here, Haas gives the example of a young Brahmin, which is the highest Indian caste, typically in the priesthood. And this young Brahmin returns home to his father after finishing his academic studies in Vedic lore. Enumerating this new knowledge, the young man is informed by his father that he hasn't learned the one thing worth knowing. And as opposed to perceiving the studies with contempt, the father simply aims to replace the lessons with new teaching. Similarly, Buddha waves aside all knowledge which is not strictly indispensable to salvation. In Confucianism, knowledge not concerned with the doctrinal core is merely auxiliary and provides a formative acquaintance with ancient ritual, music, and poetry. What there is of scientific knowledge in the East originated not because, but independent of Fallujah.
Interesting. All right, so this is the Hindu text. What's this called again?
This is from the Chandogya Upanishad. And I'm sure I mispronounced that, but it's one of the formative Hindu texts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's better than I would have done.
Yeah, close enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
So starting off with the father, I'm going to tell you right now, fetch me from thence a fruit of the Nyagrodha tree.
Here is one, sir.
Break it.
It is broken, sir.
What do you see there?
The seeds, almost infinitesimal.
Break one of them.
It is broken, sir.
And what do you see there?
Not anything, sir.
My son, that subtle essence which you do not perceive there, of that very essence this great Nyagrodha tree exists. Believe it, my son. That which is the subtle essence and all that exists has its self. It is the true. It is the self. And thou, O Svetaketu, art it. And there's a quote from Haas. From the Western point of view, well, you should probably read this because it goes along with what you're thinking, I bet.
From the Western point of view, the Indian mind should have been arrested by this recognition of oneness, or it should have embarked upon a systematic development of metaphysical speculation. Certainly, there followed a variety of philosophical systems, assenting, elaborating, interpreting, or criticizing, and contradicting. But the decisive step had been taken. What happened was this. A volt-faced, about-faced reversal was made into the self with the words, that thou art. These words are among the greatest ever spoken by man. So this is a direct quote from Haas. Is he saying that thou art being the greatest words ever spoken by man? This is from the Eastern perspective.
Yeah, this had a profound impact on Haas, and he explains why, kind of rounding out this segment. But he talks about India being convinced that the One, capital O, could not be the real, capital R, if man's self could not enter into the closest possible relationship with it. This is identity. That thou art raises institutional knowledge above the level of purely theoretical insight. and it does so by virtue of the implication in it. And you should read this because you'll know where it came from.
Become what thou art. Ah, that's where Dickie Spence got it.
Yeah, shout out Dickie Spence.
Become what you are.
Yeah, so Haas, direct quote from him, he says, the that cannot be equated with thou, man's self, so long as that self remains unchanged in its actual present state. And he talks about Godhead as a concept existing only in and for itself, essentially independent from man's self, conceived and persisting in the West and the Near East, but never occurring in Fallujah at its peak. So identity in the East is separate from man's end, goal, or purpose, and is instead determined by consummation and oneness with the real. And he gives a quote from Confucius.
It is not truth which makes man great, but man that makes truth great.
Yeah. So the fundamental idea here is borderline paradoxical, but it hammers the point home that integration with the essence is a requisite for Oriental man's development of identity, whilst also reifying the tethers he's connected to, which would be the real. You can't have one without the other, and it's symbiotic. Yeah,
can't have so, one without the other, and it's symbiotic. So the real is, again, this capital R, real.
Yeah, that would be the essence of all that exists, the building blocks, insofar as those can be defined, I guess, by the Eastern mind, the Eastern conception. And that story from the Upanishad, where this seed from a tree is broken down until you can't see what's there, it's almost like you're saying that is chaos, that is atoms, that is something broken down to the smallest microscopic constituent parts. That's what everything is made of. So that's how they reified their tether to the essence, to nature, because they're saying we're made of this same stuff.
Yeah, it's a very mathematical, geometric understanding inherently, by the way, because it's very fractal, is it not? Sort of like the fractal seedlings of the tree. The explanation is itself the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, I guess it hit Haas like a truck when he saw that thou art. Yeah, really had an impact. So.
Interesting. Yes, yes. Well, and it still impacts us, doesn't it? So Haas mentions, so this is about opposites versus polarities.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting distinction. Haas mentions form and matter being the most faithful, trenchant distinction which sprang forth from the structure of the Western mind. Tell us more.
Yeah, specifically the separation of form from content and the investigation of its significance. So examples of animate and inanimate, body and soul, thought and existence, freedom and necessity, and particularly mind and matter, all gain weight from that separation, all being opposites. And Haas calls this something that haunts the Western mind. Provisional solutions to assert an essential identity of those opposites eludes us, neither appealing to a higher unit of which they can be considered aspects or attributes, nor synthesizing through absorption with one another. Even disregarding metaphysics and focusing pragmatically, silencing these disquieting and inevitable questions remains difficult. And Haas gives the example of body and soul being hypothesized in unity through psychology and psychosomatic medicine, along with atomic physics, coming to grips with the problem of life while attacking questions of free will and teleology. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Haas doing it again. So he gives the example of body and soul. So that's hypothesized as an example of unity.
Yeah. So in this Western structure of unity and variety, these distinctions, these opposites, body and soul being irreconcilable and separate objects, can only be unified through the sciences like psychology. That's the only way that you can try to synthesize them.
So it's our closest approximation of the Eastern oneness would be unity.
Yes. Yeah, that's what Haas seems to be getting at. And he's saying later on, he literally uses the word cope. So we'll get to that.
That's funny. Okay. Well, the rifts in the Western world chronicled an extraordinary productivity engendered by pairs of opposites in metaphysics and theology, paralleled spiritual and intellectual controversies over time. Help us understand these rifts and what he's referring to.
Yeah, well, he talks about this fanatical intolerance and bloodshed often resulting from the consideration of dividing form and matter. The ideas being at once limitless and limiting. And I think he's getting at like theology with religion. It seems contradictory. It seems paradoxical. And even though it engenders creativity and productivity, trying to figure this out, being catalyzed by wonder, it creates rifts when Western mind disagrees.
So let me see if you can help me better understand what may be a distinction between Eastern and Western peoples. So the idea of dying for your religion, going to war for your religion, it's obviously not unique to the Western mind, but is it more typical of the Western mind, your understanding of the East versus the Western mind?
Yeah, I think Haas would say that it is unique to the West and to the Near East. I don't think he would say that India or China would ever do that.
I see. Yeah.
Because remember when he talked about world conquerors like Genghis Khan or Tamerlane, he specified that they were either like sticking to the nomadic traditions specific to their tribe, like Genghis, or Tamerlane being Islamic. So even though it seemed like it was a holy war, people being killed for those reasons, it wasn't inherently Eastern. Those concepts didn't come from the Eastern mind, even though they were in Asia.
Yes. Okay. Some more of that cross-pollination. Mm-hmm. So what's this about productivity stemming from the rifts? We have this concept. You've explained rifts in the Western world chronicled in extraordinary productivity engendered by pairs of opposites in metaphysics and theology. So we better understand this means that fanatical intolerance and bloodshed resulted from the consideration of dividing form and matter. So what's this about productivity stemming from the rifts becoming clearer? How does Haas explore that?
Well, seeming like a secret on the surface, this productivity stemming from the rifts becomes clear when acknowledging experience isn't the antecedent of the form and matter distinction. The free creation of autonomous reason underlies all other distinctions of opposites, yielding significance and power to them. In the totality of our experience, nothing fully resembles or embodies a pure form or a formless matter. Reason alone distinguishes the categories which cooperate in the building and evolution of both inner and outer world. And there's a quote from Haas that specifies what he means by form, if you want to read it.
Certainly, form has been considered the spontaneous formative element, be it termed God, essence, soul, idea, entelechy, mind, or thought. And the search for this form, its definition on the one hand, and the investigation of its possible cooperation with matter on the other, constitutes the main problem of Western philosophy.
Yes. Yeah. So giving the example of geometrical figures in mathematics, representing the matrices underlying the world as it extends in space and time, along with arithmetical numbers, expressing symbolically metaphysical ideas and relations to attempt defining form. Idealistic philosophy faced the problem of purporting matter's existence, while empiricist and sensualist doctrines dealt with form again. So basically, the superiority of form over matter has seldom been seriously questioned, even when materialistic pursuits prevent higher values from being realized.
And so this would be, oh no, go ahead.
I was just thinking, mind over matter, as many times as you've heard that, I think it's been misused in colloquial usage because Haas is implying that mind and matter had a split, just like object and subject, and mind is superior to matter when considering this philosophy of entelechy, or trying to define what form is, whether that be God, essence, soul, idea, mind, or thought.
Yeah, it isn't the mind that's over the matter. It's the metaphysical ideas as form over matter. Or it's like the platonically perfect concept is obviously more perfect, so to speak, than what you'll find materially.
Yes, and Haas makes reference to that later, so that's cool. And we'll get to that.
Very good. So the East and polarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so contrasting this idea of opposites, the Eastern view of polarity focuses on these limitations of opposite pairs, contrasting the inherent greatness and significance of their conception, while recognizing their peculiarity within the Western mind. In the East, opposites are better defined and understood as polarities, due to their mind structure, everything being tethered. Unlike the antagonistic opposites of the West, the polarities complete and balance each other. No one pole irreconcilable with its corresponding pole. And that would be evinced by yin-yang, mytho-philosophical connotations of heaven and earth, light and darkness, male and female, father and son, great and small, and reason and instinct, all coexisting in Taoism. So through a preordained harmony in the universe, the polarities condition and correspond to each other unproblematically.
So this Haas quote is, to the East, nature at least does not admit of genuine antagonism. While hostility and contrast exist, they are at the empirical level, and in the phenomenal world, they are irrelevant to essence. So nature does not admit of genuine antagonism. Instead, it's this empirical level contrasting.
Yes. Yeah, because the focus, without that subject-object distinction like the Western mind made, it would be on, instead of separation, distance. So because of their subject to other relation, no split had to follow, like form and matter's mutual antagonism in the East. Their distinction and subsequent separation being fundamental to the Western mind necessitated our own seemingly irreconcilable view of opposites in contrast to this Eastern polarity.
Mm-hmm. And distance doesn't negate oneness, right? So it's still all part of the whole.
Yes.
Very different. Very different.
Yeah. And that's actually the next line. In the East, nature is one whole, a single violent and irrepressible life stream, which is not entirely without an inherent regulative order. Everything contrasting instead of contradicting. So again, China has yin-yang, Taoism and Confucianism, while India experiences existence as a single and incessant stream, bearing away the numberless worlds and creatures irresistibly. Their pantheon of ambiguously sovereign deities who symbolize the structure of nature itself through uniting in the chaos of creation and destruction is a parallel there.
You know, it's really interesting as Haas is obviously choosing words very carefully. And when one considers that in the East you have contrasting, and in the West you have contradicting, let's say, as the normative inherent regulative order. Well, contrasting it brings to mind a almost like a type of friction within the machinery of the Eastern mind. Whereas contradicting, you automatically think of oppositional, pugilism, fighting, something like that. So it's very different. It's very different. Contrasting instead of contradicting.
Yeah, and a lot of it comes from a lack of distinction, right? So if you think about like hot and cold, it's kind of hard to say when does hot become cold if you're looking at it on a temperature, like on a thermometer.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be subjective. And are you even going to measure that in degrees, or are you going to try to measure it some other way? There's a parallel with Hermeticism. Like that's one of the main principles of that line of thinking is this polarity concept. And it is very Eastern.
Oh, yeah. So the East would be, they would be focusing on the shared experience of the temperature rather than the Western mind very much creates a Celsius and Fahrenheit way to describe each and every integer along the way, right? So it's kind of wild. It's really different.
Yeah. And if you think further, it's like the Western mind would say, well, we know that the temperature is cold when it's 32 degrees because that's where water turns solid.
Oh, but yeah, 34 degrees is no picnic.
Exactly. 34 degrees is not hot. So you have to look at it on a spectrum of polarity. That's like the only way. But the Western mind can't do that. So then they just come up with more and more hyper-specific, zoomed in categorizations. And then they would rationalize that with philosophy.
Yeah, think about that. We also have weird words that they probably don't have in the East when, for example, the Western mind describes the experience of a temperature. They call this temperate. Like, think about it. There's a word for, this is not too hot. This is not too cold. This is survivable while not being too hot such that it, violative of life. So they have this weird word, temperate.
Yeah, the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, it is so Western.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, and that's all I could think about, actually, when I was reading this polarity distinction from Haas is the corresponding stuff with Hermeticism. Because it seems like they just straight ripped off everything Eastern, even though it was originated in the Near East, supposedly.
Yeah, so, it's truly fascinating. Yeah, and only a person so worldly traveled and studied could sort of bring all these threads together. Make sense of it.
Yeah. And speaking of the Near East, Haas shifts focus back to ancient Persia, which he says conceived the world as based on the antagonism of good and evil as opposing parts. Approaching the Western mode of thought, its original opposition of good and evil embodied an isolation only comparable to the rigid Hebrew monotheism. Although good was considered to eventually triumph over evil, the true destruction of evil as a principle was not considered. Only the end of Angru Mainyu, the evil one, his rule. So though this view satisfied religious needs, Haas says that it was scarcely a philosophic solution to the problem of the opposites. And I had to read that a few times because I thought, this is really interesting. You have this guy, this deity, I guess, who embodies evil as a concept, as an object. But when you defeat him, evil doesn't go away. Evil is still there. And I thought, man, that's wild. So he's saying you could, misconstrue this or approximate it to a Western idea because they made this distinction, good and evil, as in opposition, as an opposite. But it's not. It's still
the East doesn't say, they say the evil ones rule, not the evil one. And this distinction is sort of hiding all of it, really, because the evil one is ruling over evil. Of course, if you kill the evil one, the evil doesn't go away. That's the Manichaean you know, emotionally potent oversimplification the Western mind is attracted to, that, you know, you defeat the evil one and there's no more evil. But of course, that is not what the Eastern mind would ever conceive of.
Right. And yet in 430 BC, you had people, Greeks like Epicurus, asking that question, whence cometh evil? Because if you understand evil as an abstraction, the Western mind is trying to figure out, well, where did this come from? And how do we understand it, categorize it, and maybe get rid of it?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with Plato, you know, his supreme ideal, which we'll get to later, it also focuses on that, this idea of good being associated with deities. So yeah, it is very interesting to see the difference, because it is stark contrast between East and West.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, either stunned by the problem of opposites in scope and scale, or unwilling to face its philosophical implications, India, China, and ancient Persia left the problem of opposite pairs untouched.
Yeah, for centuries, until the advent of Islam and Persia, it was abounding in artistic creations, but sterile in speculative thought.
And Haas says,
yeah.
Oh, yes. Then the Persian genius launched an astounding variety of creations in mystical speculation and experience, in philosophy and religious poetry, which neutralized the opposites and thus overcame not only the dualism of Zoroastrianism, but the opposition of God and man in Islam itself.
Yes, and it seems like, yeah, Haas is basically trying to say that this stagnancy or creativity, like he mentioned earlier with this concept of productivity, there's always like these correlative aspects. So when you have creativity in the West, there's always an accompanying violence or fanaticism or bloodshed. And that's because of this dialectic, like trying to neutralize opposites and synthesize them with a conception on a higher plane, basically, because you already made the split and you can't reunify them without coming up with something else to synthesize them. So you can still have like stability without the creativity, but yeah, he's basically saying that we're doomed. Like if we want this creation to continue in philosophy and surface culture, art, architecture, poetry, we have to embrace this attempt to synthesize instead of just leaving the split as is.
Yeah, and we need to take all these extra measures because of the Western mind being the hardware and software, you know, by which we analyze everything. The East would ask you, after you've made this split in something, and as you're busily engaging in this this battle that you hope would culminate in synthesis, the Eastern mind would have the advantage of reminding you. So you say you've made the split, which implies they were once one. Right? So it's like, yeah. The Eastern mind would be like, couldn't you just not do the split? And then we would remind them, no, the split's done now. We're focused on this looping stasis of, you know, sort of a hollow synthesis, the hollow search for synthesis constantly. And then and guess what? Once we have that synthesized, we're going to split it again. And then we're going to keep doing this.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is the Western way.
Yeah. Which is why we have the uninvited parasite. You know, this sort of splitting and synthesis and all this din, it does lend itself, all this splitting of the object, it lends itself to capitalism, it lends itself to the middlemaning. it is the friend of the Jew, because the, you know, when you separate good and evil, even as these black and white sort of opposites, well, the Jew will get busy creating faux good and monetize that, and then selectively monetize evil. They literally even monetize that. You consider what they do.
Yeah, I just had a light bulb go off as you were talking, because I was thinking about these concepts of middlemanning, like you said. Instead of telling you what you need to hear, there's a focus on what people want to hear. Mm-hmm. That lends to the success of a lot of institutions, whether they be educational or religious or governmental. And it's sort of like, instead of this natural inclination towards philosophy and doing the work, actually thinking, using your brain, if the Jew comes and offers this bridge between what was severed, this tether between subject and object, a lot of people will go for that instead of trying to build the bridge themselves. So yeah, this is making a lot more sense to me now, the way that you said that, because it's one thing to just say the Jews middlemanning, but there's so many other specific examples that are popping into my head now, you know, associated with that concept. And it all comes down to laziness, basically. It's like, as a Western person, you have a natural propensity to philosophize. That's how you view the world. And if somebody is offering you an easier way, it takes a rare breed to say, nope, I want to do the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm. And rather than do the hard stuff, the middlemanning Jew does one thing more than just tell people what they want to hear, that confirmation rather than information element, which really does resonate with the Western mind. Boy, when someone's telling us what we want to hear, boy, do we love listening. But there's this other aspect. The Jew is the master of exploiting insecurities. So you combine telling people what they want to hear while simultaneously exploiting their insecurities, and you have the perfect recipient of the middleman's message.
Yes. Masterfully said, Davis. That's good shit.
There we go. Mm-hmm. So going from the Persian genius, the East takes opposites as they are from nature, immediately experienced in life. Tell us more about how the East perceives opposites and what that means to their overall thinking about polarities.
Yes. Well, because it's about experience and not appearance, which goes in line with what Haas has outlined before, recognizing the principle of contraries, opposite pairs are left in their original context and operation. For this reason, they have been interpreted by contemplative thought as polarities, whose contrariety conceals the deeper meaning of balance and harmony. That's in the East. But the Western mind, rooted in Greek philosophy, projects the pairs of opposites into the comprehension of life and nature, regarded as ontological and inherent in existence itself. Because of the split, that subject-object, form-matter split, boundless creativity accompanies the Western mind due to the fact that a complete understanding or ontological explanation of opposites isn't really contained in the nature of things, which is why the polarity of the Eastern view makes the pairs easier to simply accept with finality.
Hmm.
Do you want to read this quote from Haas? Give it a little bit more, flesh it out some?
Yes. The fact of matter has been cause for grave perplexity in Greek as in modern philosophy. For the failure to solve the problem of matter's coexistence and cooperation with form has led the Western mind to a somewhat desperate consideration of matter as the only reality. This is just as if a blind submission to a blind master were a safer way to enlightenment than coping with the dilemma.
Yes. Brutal. Wow. From Haas.
Yeah. Oh boy.
But Yeah, I took note here because this reminded me of a scene in Breaking Bad where the main character, Walt, and his old chemistry lab assistant, Gretchen, are analyzing a breakdown of the chemical elements making up a human body. So they say there's 63% hydrogen, 26% oxygen, 9% carbon, 1.25% nitrogen, and a bunch of other trace elements. Everything added up only accounts for 99.888%, leaving 0.1119% unaccounted for. And neither scientist knows what that could be, so they jokingly call it the soul, or just assume they made a mistake. And I feel like that's a parallel here because Haas is saying this consideration of matter as the only reality, because we refuse to acknowledge or accept this inherent affinity correspondence, a tether with something like energy or some other abstraction, ends up with the Western mind just coping.
Oh, yeah, a lot of coping. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is so absurd, especially when you consider that rather than incorporate or deal with the metaphysical aspects of this, you'd rather just ignore the fact that your very materialistic thinking was literally born of a philosophical tradition of understanding matter, was born of metaphysics. Yeah. Metaphysics came first. And here we are later, ignoring the thing that gave birth to the type of thinking you're using to ignore metaphysics.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
You know, the Western mind is in a lot of trouble. I mean, it has its advantages, but yes. Consider a type of thinking where you're allowed to either leave a given percentage unaccounted for or call it the soul. You can either be like, well, they made an error, or, oh, no, that's the soul.
Yeah.
This is a confounding synthesis in one case and a really good question in the other.
Well, yeah, because ultimately somebody taking that route as a scientific mind philosopher, they're going to say, oh, we just made the errors. We rounded up or rounded down incorrectly. Or maybe some other aspect of the experiment was wrong. You know, they're not going to think truly that there is something else undiscoverable. They'd rather just pretend like that's not real and just relegate it to something else that is explainable.
Right. Rather than deal with what's confounding, you can just make another split and then continue on a synthesis of the new split.
Exactly.
It's literally what happened in this example. The split is it's the soul or it's an incorrect calculation. There you go. Time to synthesize away at that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Interesting. So focus on logos. Oh, this should be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Haas makes a shift again to focus on logos. And he starts with Parmenides, severing reality from the sense perceived world. And Haas mentions this schism between mind and matter unfolding, identifying and stigmatizing empirical knowledge as misleading. Logos was born from this philosophy of Parmenides. And Pythagoras and Plato each conceived the split as between form and matter, admitting close existence of the two while maintaining a fundamental separation of the logos and empirical knowledge. So the problem became determining what the forms were and how they connected with matter to better understand their final purpose. It's kind of like the origin of the telos or the teleology.
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. So being the sovereign creative reason, logos was conceived as totally distinct from the psychophysical nature of man. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, that includes his intellect, which is always oriented toward practicality. And equally important to this fact is the nature of logos being considered ascertainable. And that's huge. Haas points out, in the Middle Ages, Christ, as the revelation incarnate, superseded and at the same time carried on the Greek philosophical view. Modern philosophy, in opposition to the medieval, stresses clarity and distinctiveness as the criterion of all logos-born truths, developing rationalism to produce incontestable truths from principles like mathematics. Yeah. And Haas opines that a focus on mathematics stifles the self-confidence and creativity of philosophy, as it lacks the stimulating power that inspires men to produce greater understandings and explanations.
Well, sometimes. I mean, you have the exceptions, obviously, like Isaac Newton.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Haas points out Kant, specifically as the representative of this great demarcation line, saying that a shift from philosophers exalting logos occurred when Kant denied it to the capacity of arriving independently at unquestionable metaphysical truths, confining the power of pure reason to the analysis of the formal conditions of experience. So Kant maintained that mathematics and logic were the only sources of a priori knowledge. Theoretical philosophy was judged incapable of revealing substantial and fundamental truth. So according to Haas, logos was dethroned with Kant's assertions.
And here the natural question to ask is, did Haas believe it was literally, logos was literally dethroned with Kant's assertions, or is it more like, as generally understood by philosophers, logos was dethroned by Kant's assertions?
No, I'm pretty sure he's saying with that great demarcation line that this is like irreversible and that it affected everything.
Huh, well, that's stunning. It would have such implications. So the simplicity of 4 plus 4 equaling 8 or 2 plus 2 equaling 4 somehow devalues all other knowledge by way of theoretical philosophy, because of the explanatory power of a priori knowledge being so obvious in 2 plus 2 equals 4. That's a strange way, but there it is again, the Western mind creating the split. And now we're seeing the struggle of synthesis where logos is dethroned with Kant's assertions.
Yeah. Cause basically, like you said, Kant would look at Parmenides saying thinking equals being. And Kant would say, what are you talking about? You know, that's not legit. Like, there's no reason to that. So, yeah, 4 plus 4 equals 8 is solidified as this true knowledge. But just because you did the philosophizing on an object, it doesn't make your understanding true empirically.
Mm-hmm. Right, because numbers are representations of physical things. So this is a... rather than an advancement, I would dare say it's a regression to a materialistic requirement for knowledge. In other words, theoretical philosophy is now degraded in favor of a priori knowledge, something precisely provable.
Yeah. And like Kant said about God, we talked about in the last one, he said it's like an axiom, you know? So there's a lot of things that he said just exist as is, and you can take them for granted.
Mm.
And that would be the a priori knowledge.
Yeah. I don't know why this does, but it bothers me. Thinking logos is dethroned with Kant's assertions. Yeah. There's something disturbingly oversimplified about it. But I also see...
Haas fleshes it out more.
Yeah. Oh, good. I also see how it's undeniable. So, yeah.
Yeah, like we said before, Haas pulls no punches. So he's not afraid to hurt our feelings sometimes. Yeah.
So the Western schism between logos and the empirical world, resulting in an irreconcilable pairs of opposites, is alien to the East.
Yeah. Because they're not interested in shaping the non-subject into an independent object. So the East simply ranks the non-self as other, like we've talked about before. And the main problem from the beginning of Eastern civilization was to secure an unassailable position for man in the face of all that exists within and around him, neutralizing the hostile antagonism of opposites by embracing polarity. And Haas talks about the Hegelian idea of dialectics, and he says differing from that, overcoming the hostility by raising up a synthesizing principle that neutralizes the opposites on a higher plane. The Eastern polarity understanding is that radically different poles work magnetically, pulled in different directions, but not against each other. At a determined point, the poles neutralize each other. And this point of neutralization symbolizes the real, capital R, the essence.
Oh, no, that's interesting. Yeah. Yes, yes. Right. Yeah, instead of ripping the earth apart, it's in this magnetic pole balance. It's only by the interaction does, you know, the equatorial bulge hold. Whereas the Western mind would be trying to rip the earth in half along the axes or the equator.
Yeah. And like you said before, with this Western conception of temperate, that's kind of what this balance point would be, where the poles neutralize each other, where it's neither hot nor cold. That would be symbolic of the real in these Eastern ideas like Confucianism and Taoism and Hinduism.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. So the again, this Eastern approximation of philosophy called philousia. In Eastern philousia, the real, capital R, absorbs the polarities, whereas the Western absolute conciliates the opposites on a higher plane in a new creation of the mind.
Yeah, and this is good because basically juxtaposition of contraries in the Eastern mind, not fighting each other, being absorbed into the identity of the real, juxtaposition and identity, versus this variety of dynamic antagonisms in the Western mind, transcending to unification through developing higher function and philosophized principle. So again, perfect overlay with Haas's thesis, this structural principles that are demonstrable. This is how he's demonstrating it.
Yeah, that is wild. And again, this very useful term, dynamic antagonisms, you know, in the Western kind of thinking, transcending to unification. So again, resonating with the synthesis, you know, the end of the Hegelian dialectic.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because like we've talked about before, when you have these contraries or these opposites, which the West would see as contradictory, we're trying to tie them all together with reason and figure out if they can be unified somehow. And if they're not, then we throw it away. We can't accept it. We refuse because we say, no, that's contradictory. It can't be true. And in the Eastern mind, there can't be a contradiction because it's just a contrariety.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So now, Haas, there's a couple of pages of recapitulation. Why don't you tell us about that before I read the next Haas quote?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually didn't take notes on those pages because Haas basically recapitulated what he's been outlining so far in the earlier chapters, tying it all together. He mentions how mathematics and evolution were embraced by the East and West in different ways, adhering to their own structures, which he's observed and elucidated. But since we've been doing that consistently throughout each session, I decided to just truncate and move on to the next subsection, where Haas focuses on modern science again.
Well, okay. And here's a Haas quote. With the recognition that no scientific fact can exist abstractly and apart from the observer, or his position and his means of observation, the subject had to be admitted as constituting the scientific fact itself. It cannot be foreseen whether this conception will influence philosophical thought. But this change is momentous. The observer is no longer an unwelcome additum, which should be eliminated. He is now recognized as a constituent element. This is the observer effect in all this explored.
Yeah, and this gets pretty wild. This is the start of the Arthur Eddington mentions by Haas. But the idea here is that Western mind, following one conception to another in pursuit of understanding nature, will eventually end its journey with the discovery and comprehension of mind itself. And this quote from Arthur Eddington, that 20th century astronomer, physicist, and mathematician, regarding an imagined situation of finding a universal mathematical formula, Eddington says, "In the end, mind faces itself." Mm-hmm. And this is another statement that had a tremendous impact on Haas, because he says, believing this vision to reveal the Western mind structure with not entirely unambiguous clarity. There's a block quote from Haas. You want to read it?
Certainly. With this knowledge, the position of nature becomes problematic. When the mind has found itself, does it continue to exist, though deprived of value? Does it disappear, its seeming reality dissolved? Or is the recognized identity of the mind and nature the ultimate result? What is important is the fact that the mind faces and recognizes itself as in a mirror. Although the formula is not an object in the current sense of the term, it retains a kind of objectiveness, for it is a product of the mind, not the mind itself. Thus, what the mind learns at the end is that it can only know itself, that it has been misled and lured on by a specter.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. It is kind of obtuse, but Haas does flesh it out more, and I think it'll make sense by the end.
It's not so obtuse. It is a worrying idea from Eddington that in the end, mind faces itself. It's like, well, if we take that seriously, this means when man fully understands and comprehends the mind itself, where it's no longer some amorphous, nondescript property, emergent property of the brain, the hardware called the brain. This means it's the end. Well, that can't be a good thing. Or at the very least, I can't imagine anything good that would come after man's full understanding of the mind itself.
Yeah. Well, I think what's wild about this idea, this ultimate formula, and the statement from Haas is that the focus on gaining knowledge through philosophy in the Western mind is about nature, the sum of instincts, the environment around you, objectifying and observing everything to better understand yourself as a subject. And it seems like Eddington's quote about the mind facing itself is a result of looking at nature. So it's strange. It's like by accident, you eventually find out about something that you weren't intending to pursue. And in so doing, it supplants everything else that you learned in pursuit of something different.
So this is about a denaturalization of nature.
Yeah. Well, that's the comparison that Haas makes. This eventual denaturalization of nature, he compares to the consummation of scientific advancement, positing that knowledge will ultimately be depersonalized and supplanted by mind. So
what does that look like?
Science doesn't resolve with the sum total of comprehending and categorizing natural phenomena. It will not be satisfied until psychological phenomena are controlled and understood by scientific insight. If this moment is achieved, the subjects of knowledge themselves become objectified. Their reality enters and is absorbed by the universal formula, that mind facing itself.
Let us hope that the psychological phenomena are not ultimately understood through the lens of Freudianism.
Yeah, let's hope, right?
Yeah. Or maybe that's the gift of the Jews. We'll never get to the point where discovery and comprehension of the mind itself is ever reached. Because again, I don't know if anything good comes after, in the end, mind faces itself.
Well, yeah, where's your Sinead drop that says, thanks, Jews?
Yeah, that would be appropriate. I mean, think about what he's asking. With this knowledge, the position of nature becomes problematic. When the mind has found itself, does it continue to exist, though deprived of value? I'm not sure it's deprived of value so much as maybe it becomes, rather than deprived of value, it almost becomes the prime value.
Well, Davis, I think what Haas is getting at is this concept of object, because it's objectified. The value of an object would be categorized in that way, on those terms. So if you can't categorize it as an object anymore, then it has no value because there's nowhere to categorize it. It's something else entirely.
Oh, I was rather thinking that when man meets the discovery and comprehension of mind itself, absolutely, I rather thought it would be a mechanistic understanding of every aspect of the brain, and therefore understanding the component parts of the emergent property we call consciousness. And I was picturing a nightmare scenario where, imagine this could be mechanistically understood, influenced, and manipulated. Like I said, that's explaining why I'm thinking nothing good can come after this.
Well, there's a distinction, or rather a comparison, that Haas makes between Eddington's vision, that mind facing itself, and Aristotle.
Ah, so okay.
Mind, in recognizing itself and a formula which has resulted from its quest for the comprehension of nature, reaches the insight that the mind itself is its own proper object. And Aristotle's definition of a supreme being is the cognition of cognition. Mm-hmm. So, practically a dream, this pure form of knowledge cannot have any other object but itself. And Parmenides is referenced again with his statements regarding thought and the object of thought in reality being identical.
Interesting. Yes. So this is a reference to metacognition, Aristotle's definition of a supreme being the cognition of cognition. This is a gift of the Western mind, metacognition, and yet a relative few engage in it.
Yeah. Well, like you've said before, thinking about your own thinking is one thing, but fully understanding it as an object, completely separate in and of itself, as this concept of mind, that's a scary thought.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, so recognizing the impersonality of the Western structure oriented towards focus on the object, Haas explores personality again as a psychological antidote against the structure. Accepting those writing under the influence of Christianity, Western philosophers conferred on the absolute an impersonal character, practically demanding self-forgetting and self-abnegation with a sort of theoretical asceticism. Western philosophy in practice pushes its creator to embrace exaggerated worldliness by exalting personality.
Interesting. And
yeah, this incomparable array of great personalities in the West may be interpreted as a human protest against the mind structure bent on objectification. I thought that was a pretty cool take.
Oh, like these are the antibodies against a, yeah, against this mind facing itself.
Yeah, and paradoxically, those same men of action that are pushing things forward within the Western structure typically stand out personality-wise due to their proportional revolt by way of embracing the psychological antidote, which is personality.
Excellent. Let me take a break at this moment because we're at 10:04, actually. We're about to get into Plato's supreme idea, identifying good with the deity, and go from there. But right now, I wanted to take the opportunity to remind you and visit the chat. So here we go. Let me go ahead over to F to the T to the J. And what we have here is Alex Waslak going to catch the rest on replay. Well, yes, good job, good job. And he gave $5.56, saying this is Luke's Freedom Fries money. G-Man's in the chat, and Annie Waffen asking, are mind and soul one the same then? Your thoughts, Luke?
I would say no. But again, the soul similarly is an abstraction that isn't fully understood beyond a concept. So maybe once the mind faces itself, as in Eddington's ultimate formula, we'll understand the soul too. Who knows?
Oh, yes. We'll account for the 0.1114%.
Yeah.
When the mind faces itself, which could be a lot of trouble, by the way. We don't really know. It depends on the split and the acrimonious synthesis that will come about. But Annie Waffen giving $20, we really appreciate that, over at F to the T to the J. So thank you, dear. And
excellent.
Yes.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Oh, my gosh.
Excellent. We have over at Odyssey, no donos with lots of questions. If we have time at the end, this is a fairly long chapter. So if we have time at the end, we'll go ahead and take a look at those. Sermon Bull having some thoughts and many, many others. So that's good. It's an active chat. They're having a good time discussing this amongst themselves. So Luke, before I rudely interrupted a transition from Plato's supreme idea, identifying good with the deity, take us from there.
Yes. So that's something that you brought up earlier that we referenced, Plato's supreme idea, identifying good with the deity. This did not possess a personality character, personality hyphen character is how Haas wrote it. And religion was thus borrowed from to shield against the assault of skepticism or sensualism, providing the necessary safeguards in the ideas of a personal God. And those religions would have been non-Western in origin, like Zoroastrianism or Christianity. But considering God's world and man-creating act and his appearance on Earth, the objectifying strain of Western mind structure is evinced once again. And I took note of this because I think this is very interesting. If observable and unique personalities were believed to spring forth from men embracing the objectivity with greater magnitude than average, masses would be more inclined to follow a leader embodying prestige as equated to their efforts, because people assume a great personality equals a lot of accomplishments. So considering God as a Western man follows this principle by projecting a great personality onto him as a necessity in order to feel like he's worthy of being deified and worshipped, God must transcend man's limit of ascertainable knowledge.
So yes, it shows a lack of imagination in the Western man, by the way.
Yes.
If the Western man were at all considering what is generally understood as a true concept of God, this is the progenitor. This is something so pervasive and ubiquitous. It is something so alien to everything material that we understand that There's all likelihood that God could not even be described. And yet you see this profane, almost silly personification of God by the Western man. It's such silly folly.
Yes.
Guy with a beard and a big clock and all this.
Yeah. Well, because how else are you going to, like you said, the lack of imagination. With philosophy and objectivity, you probably couldn't come up with something like this because it seems contradictory. You have to kind of reach into metaphysics in an almost goofy way. So if you take something that's already established from, like Haas said earlier, the East always impressed the West. You associate this prestige with their accomplishments and then borrow from it. It still doesn't fit. It still doesn't fit the Western mind because it doesn't have personality. So you have to project personality onto him necessarily. And that's how you have this this concept of a God who has to transcend your limits, because otherwise he's just another dude.
Yeah, right. Well, that is implicit, right? It's an implicit understanding. God must be the total and the everything. Can't just be another guy.
Yeah.
But the only way to typify that, the only way to make that understood to others, is to project a personality onto this indefinable thing.
Right. And Haas is saying that this personality comes from, it's like an antidote. It's retaliatory against the Western mind structure of objectivity. So you have to basically take yourself out of the equation when you're observing things or philosophizing things, because the focus is on the object, not you. So you lose yourself to this self-abnegation, and developing a great personality is in direct revolt against that as a psychological antidote. So by projecting a great personality onto God, you're going to say that the things that he did are revolting against the Western mind structure, revolting against objectivity. This is like revelatory for me. I love this.
Oh yeah. And
yeah,
you would think the psychological fallout from that would be like ego dissolution, which is where the willingness to enter into conflict for this idea of God comes from. You've literally become so unimportant. You've removed yourself such that I'm doing God's will is the reason, the whole of everything. Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
And it feels natural to a Western man because we're already disintegrated and not absorbed into the essence or the real, like an Eastern man.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a prerequisite vector. That box is already ticked for us.
So compared to the West, the East represents an unequivocal and more consistent aspect. What's meant by this?
Yes. So in the East, the emphasis on subject, inherent in their mind structure, confers a meaning on the absolute, which implies a severance. And Haas uses the Latin word absolvere here, which means complete, finish, off, away from. So that would be the etymological root of absolute or absolution, like split. Mm. So the real, capital R, replaces the absolute, recognized as a splitting off, which maintains a definite closeness to the subject. In Confucianism, Taoism, and the Indian Upanishads, the identical real and great self is recognized in all that exists, like that story between the father and son and the seeds.
Yes.
Yes. So
interesting.
I'll warn you ahead of time.
Go ahead, buddy.
This next bit is probably the most difficult thing, the most difficult concept so far for the Western mind.
Comparing the Western and Eastern deities?
Yes. Yeah, just this whole segment, you know, these couple sentences.
Okay.
Even Haas admits the atmosphere of ambiguity here. So you want to go ahead and read it?
Certainly, comparing the concept of Western and Eastern deities, Haas points out the motive behind the Upanishad formulation, the desire to avoid anything which might suggest an objectified absolute capital A that is an absolute existing in and for itself. Thus, an unconditioned subject must not convey the connotation of personality in order to transcend personified deities as well as any other kind of objectified existence. What can be called personality in the East, in the Eastern view, I should say, is not the essence of the individual. The essence is the real capital R, intrinsically proximal to man, which guarantees a conception implying an identity that's neither nebulous nor objective.
Yeah, that's a pretty tough one to chew on. Yeah. Well, my take is this Eastern experience and orientation leads to identity, which recognizes the subject, the self, as a constituent element, but a non-disintegrated or absorbed sense of personality can't be determined theoretically beyond that. The Western man is unable to equal the Eastern position without borrowing from religion. This is just like a really hard one to wrap our head around.
So wait a second. What role is religion playing for the Western man that it does not play for the Eastern man?
Well, this concept of projecting a personality onto a deity with abstractions like, how significantly they revolted against the structure of objectivity as we understand it in the Western mind.
So wait, I could have sworn I've seen Eastern representations of God as, you know, creatures and all of this.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Haas talks about that. He actually talked about it earlier, like this chaotic pantheon of distinct but amalgamated deities in the Hindu religion. So they're kind of amorphous, like they're at once representative of creation and destruction, and they have distinct representations and names, but it still comes down to polarity as opposed to opposites, because they're just operating, taking on different forms at different ends of the spectrum. It's like, yeah, at once amalgamated and separate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so those personifications are fractal, whereas Western personifications are they're precedents to conflict or the need for synthesis. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that would be embodied with the monotheism and the dichotomy, like in the Near East with Zoroastrianism and then Christianity. These concepts of good and evil being opposites instead of polarity. So it does track, but where I get hung up on is this personality.
Yeah.
Because the Eastern mind doesn't have to project a personality onto the subject, the self, even though they're a constituent element of this greater amalgam. So looking at it through the Western lens is just very confusing.
Yeah, because in the Eastern view, this personality business is not the essence of the individual.
Right.
Which we can't, I have trouble even processing that.
Yeah, so they can still have a personality, but Western man just can't really fully comprehend this. Like even Haas says, I'm just doing my best trying to explain this because I'm not an Eastern man. I can't. Yeah.
Well, tell us about the noteworthy parallel between the Eastern and Western structures, and then I'll read the Haas quote.
Yes. Yeah. So one noteworthy parallel exists between the Eastern and Western structure, although not an inner relation. And Haas says the subject, which is the consummation of Eastern mind after exiting the magic world, is not linked with personality in the Eastern mind. The absolute, constituting the conclusion of Western mind's object distinction, has no relation to any concrete physical object.
Haas says, nevertheless, the absolute, not only retains its objectiveness, but is objectiveness itself, the object.
Yeah. So I think he's saying that's the closest approximation that we can comprehend, is this Western idea of the absolute. It's still objectified, but it's not concrete. And that's the closest we can get to the East having an identity through personality as a self, the subject, whilst still being a constituent element of the greater collective real or the essence.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So Haas revisits this idea of scientific progress.
Yeah. Yeah. Understanding nature as an increasingly less concrete image with continued scientific progress. The Western mind is faced with an ever more subtle and unseizable world conception, matter and energy blurring the observable atomic makeup. Even when fully detached from matter, the universal formula, Eddington's mind facing itself, continues to point at the object called nature or mind or both, along with its associated imagery.
Hmm. Well, I immediately thought of, you know, this business of matter and energy blurring the observable atomic makeup. It is interesting that the more matter is studied, the less definite everything becomes. You've heard this business of matter not really having the constituent parts being atoms in the traditional sense. It's not sort of like little solar systems, teeny tiny tiny solar systems. It's not that at all. As it turns out, all these structures exist in a sort of cloud of probability, not at all this mechanistic swirling on different axes.
Yeah, and that comes along with discovering things like quarks and bosons and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to whatever extent that's real, sure.
Sure, yeah. The quantum shit.
No, yeah, because that seems, yeah, it's just doing the praxis of the super microscopic, you know, down to the nanometer scale. It's just sort of more of the same, but again, we don't, it's sort of like the smaller it gets, the less real it becomes, but they have an explanation for the way it works, which makes it more real to the Western mind. You know, yeah. Clouds of probability is not exactly the same thing as we were promised in the study of the atom. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, and in the context with the end of Eddington's formula, it makes sense, right? Because the lines are blurred between what we know and what we discover, and you eventually question more and more, but you're still researching nature. You're not trying to figure out about how your own cognition, your own mind, and how it works. You're just doing the thing. So eventually you won't discover what it is you sought to discover through looking at observable atomic makeup. You'll discover the mind instead on accident.
Well, this literally already happened in some small way. Again, the observer phenomenon aspect,
yeah,
was revelatory to, well, many, many things, philosophy, physics, the collapsing of the wave function, how that might change matter. It's all very strange.
Well, yeah, because whatever it is you're looking at, inherently you're changing it by observing it. So
yeah,
the knowledge that you gain, it's still not concrete. It has the caveat, you know, like, oh, this is what we discovered while observing this object. And then asterisk, because we observed it, you know, this is the extent of which we can know, but it could be totally different when we're not looking at it. Like we've talked about before, the double slit. Is it particle or wave? You know, it's both until you look at it. And Haas actually does mention that in a footnote.
Oh, that's
earlier on. Yeah. Well, not that specifically, but he mentioned Schrodinger. They said this would be a good example of relatively modern science going in this direction.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Well, let's get to that.
Yeah.
Both Western and, I believe we're here now, right? The,
yes.
The Western philosophical and scientific conceptions stand out in stark contrast to the real, capital R, in Eastern philousia, which again is this made-up word, this neologism, to describe the closest approximation of Eastern philosophy Haas could arrive at.
Yeah, the love of knowledge versus the love of essence as the impetus. And transcending the physical and Western conception of objectiveness is an ideal knowable in principle, but its potential consummation is distant in the infinitely remote future, this mind facing itself. So I guess that's a bit of a consolation, but also foreboding. It's kind of spooky to think about.
Well, I mean, I see it as the glass half full. Again, I can't imagine anything good that comes out of these very flawed people among us today having a complete and total understanding of the mind. I don't know. Again, this just seems like a good thing will always be the dog chasing the car bumper, never having attained it. That might be a good thing. That might be the best news so far in this book.
Yeah, that's why Haas says it's a long ways off. So don't worry about it too much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, better change human nature before we reach that. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's the end of the chapter. Just to conclude everything, I took note, tried to summarize it. Basically, the Eastern view of polarity affords them a less confrontational existence without curiosity nagging for objectification like the West. Discovering harmony with the real by way of observing balance points along the spectrum between contrary poles, experience supersedes appearance, which allows Eastern man to consider his connected understanding satisfactory. And contrarily, forced to investigate and philosophize everything made object through our original split with the magic world, Western man discovers each nascent comprehension of an object, engendering more pathways to continued knowledge, ultimately terminating in the apotheosis of Eddington's ultimate formula, the mind facing itself. Conceptualizing the character of wisdom before and after it's fully nailed down in demonstrable understanding, Western mind will forever search and build towards the end.
So it's like a Zeno's paradox thing. Even when we get to the end, we'll do another split and have to synthesize, and forever it'll be like this. It'll be the end that was split, and then you're attaining a new end which splits. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, what's wild to think about is if Western man ever reaches this ultimate formula, how will Eastern man react to that, watching from the outside? They'd probably be thinking, interesting. Seems like Westerners came to a new understanding. But for them, they don't have this spooky event horizon constantly looming over them. There's no equivalent.
A less confrontational existence is... What I was thinking... my readings is, I wonder, it doesn't seem like it's possible, but I suppose given a long enough time horizon, it's entirely possible that the Eastern and Western mind, you know, goodness forbid, through a Kalergi type of alchemical processing of the human race, I wonder if the Eastern and Western mind would come to a synthesis. Like, imagine a nightmare world where white people disappear into a morass of, you know, brownish gray goo of humanity, this semi-brown biomass. There would have to be a melding or synthesis of the Eastern and Western mind, or would it be a biomass of semi-brown humanity that's entirely schizophrenic and in conflict with itself?
Yeah, that seems more likely to me.
Yeah. Yeah. On account of this is the schizophrenia and latent schizotypy we see in the browns and the blacks and the Jews.
I just I just had a thought, because in Mein Kampf, Hitler makes a point to speak on behalf of nature, which is kind of you know, playing fast and loose, and it's dangerous territory. When he's talking about miscegenation, he says this is like an abomination. Nature does not like this. Nature doesn't want it. And he points to all these animal species and breeds that don't procreate. They don't even associate. And Ben Klassen expounded on that more. Like, he talked about, oh, look at these 300 different kinds of swallows, and they all remain totally homogenous. They don't interbreed. But obviously that's wrong with regards to humans, because there are still all these mixed races that don't just get rejected and die. So nature does allow it, even if whites like you and I would look at it and get grossed out. When you look at fucking Brazil or something, it's disgusting. But those people are still living. They're still kicking. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of forgot where I was going with that. But something you said sparked it off.
Yeah, you were visiting with us the terrifying end, which could be a sustainable, albeit miserable, semi-brown biomass of humanity.
Yes, so that there wouldn't really be like a hybridization that would be beneficial, I don't think. It's closer to what you said, like everybody's just this conflicted, contradictory, confused schizo mass. But at the same time, there already is evidence of those people being, I don't even know what term to use. Like, I guess they're just living a relatively normal life, insofar as normal can be used to describe it. They're just dumb. Like, they're just low IQ. But they don't seem super confused with regards to being pulled in different directions. You know, I think they're just low IQ. I think the Jews are the only ones who have this, like, successfully hybridized bits of both somehow. Like, they were, maybe they really are God's chosen. Because he gave them characteristics of both Eastern and Western mind. But then again...
successful being a relative term here.
Yes, yeah. And Jews also have this biological predisposition for things like schizophrenia occurring at a much higher rate. So, yeah, that's a parallel maybe with what you're saying. If they do have those characteristics, maybe it's because of that hybridization. Who knows?
Right, so the Jew is crafting a future, an eventual possible future, in which Jews themselves will be indispensable Freudian analysts.
Yeah, they're the only ones who have the lens through which to look and understand. Sure.
Yeah, or so they believe, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the only price they have to pay is getting Tay-Sachs disease.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good trade-off to me now, but I don't want to, I don't want to visit the semi-brown biomass of humanity. That's not a future I look forward to, but yeah, hopefully, again, we don't know where any of this leads. We like to think what Hitler says resonates with us, speaking on behalf of nature. Sure, that can be problematic, although, you know, there's just something that seems so true about the idea. It's something a child grasps easily. This idea, like, you know, birds of a feather, it's, you don't have to explain it to a child. Children have to be, they have to be indoctrinated to think breeding with blacks and browns is something to do. Otherwise, yeah, there's an inherent disgust react even among babies when they see people of different races.
Yes. Are you familiar with the poem, One Sheath, One Vine?
No.
Okay. It was mentioned in Pierce's portrait. I know they don't call it a biography, even. That's pretty much what it was. But Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, Pierce brings that up. And I forget who wrote it. But that's pretty much the concept, is like this inherent, innate propensity to want to be around your own people. Like, these fake Jew concepts of racism, or whatever terms they created, are just explaining these natural inclinations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like these... white people don't want to be around niggers, and that's totally natural. There's nothing unnatural about it.
Oh yeah. And do you remember IQ nationalism had a little resurgence? And I quickly escaped from that. I mean, I see the appeal, the idea that it's beneficial to have lots of high IQ people. Like, okay. But that was something that had to be smuggled into white nationalism and had to bastardize the concept of whites having preferential treatment for whites, preferring the self instead of the other. And it didn't stick around very long. To the extent it still does, it's pretty ill-defined, and people inherently seem to know it's a bad idea, because what's preferred is to just advance white interest, just to say, I don't care if some other is smarter than some of my fellow white people. Like, that's a... You, Jew, you can take your merit-based bullshit and go shove it, because that's just a vehicle for the Jew to insinuate himself into white systems and take them over, or otherwise water them down, bastardize them, whatever you want to call it. Instead, it seems very natural. It seems as if you're speaking for nature's God to say, no, I don't really care how smart this given white person is. I just want good things for white people. And that seems entirely self-consistent. And it doesn't seem like a stretch at all. You know, whereas the idea of IQ nationalism seems like you have to start bending yourself around trees.
Yeah.
So I don't think Hitler was doing anything that we all don't do every day when we pretend to speak for nature's God. Because it is like that. You think about it. So assume what everyone knows about nature's God is true. So there's this being, and he makes all these races and literally separates them such that they come to have different nations, and nations comes from natal and means born of a people. And so here they are all separate. It really is outrageous. So, like, given all those conditions being true, it's fucking outrageous that someone would suggest, oh, no, you know, fuck that guy. Just go mix them all up.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's literally an outrage against nature and nature's God.
Well, we've talked about this before, the argument of using that word natural, which I just did. Fully realizing the problematizing it, but it does feel natural to the people who are doing it. So we can't use it an argument against them, the antecedent of we being white people, telling other white people that fuck niggers, hey, that's unnatural, because they think it is natural for some reason. They've been tricked, swindled, misled, manipulated, however you want to say it, but they fully believe that it's normal. So to say that nature doesn't allow it and nature doesn't want it and nature hates it, the argument falls flat when those people are allowed to do that and they're allowed to live. That's my take on it.
Yeah. Yeah. There should have been, right. It would have been much better if nature's God had built into other failed species this trigger of failure once they mixed. That would have been really beneficial.
Right. Exactly. Like, there would be no such thing as a mulatto, because they would just fucking die as soon as they were born or before they were born.
Right. So it would be birds of a feather.
They just wouldn't even conceive.
Right. Don't even conceive. Yeah. Like birds of a feather or Terminus. Mm-hmm. You know, some people can conceive together, and yet they can go partner with other people and they will conceive. So there's something at work there. Compatibility, incompatibility, but it's, my understanding is it doesn't follow along racial lines. It follows something more along the order of blood types.
Yeah. Well, that seems like something that some Aryan scientists need to get on right away and fucking exploit to the max.
Yeah, see if we can amplify that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wouldn't even have to be eugenics on the surface. You could easily market it as something else, something beneficial for all the people who get 20 gorillion vaccine jabs. They probably wouldn't have any issue taking yet another one.
Oh, sure. And we just need a little nudge, because a little nudge in the right direction plus state power incentivizing and de-incentivizing. You know, you just don't offer IVF to mixed race couples. You don't have to put people in jail or kill them. I understand we love those fantasies. Mm-hmm. But let's say you wanted to do this a way that was longer term and less conflict ridden. This would ultimately mean a world in 100, 150 years of no mulattoes with right. a little nudge and state power incentivizing or de-incentivizing reproduction.
Yeah, that's all it would take is just, not even de-incentivizing, but just stop subsidizing.
Right.
That's step one.
Yes, which again reminds us all why white people have to be the ones at the flagpole. Because as wild as that idea sounds, and we understand that the average normie would balk at the concept of genetically nudging the entire human race such that certain people couldn't reproduce as easily because they would be mixed couples. And the idea of then incentivizing certain behaviors through state power. Like, sure, the normie would balk at that, but this would seem perfectly normal if white people were at the flagpole raising that flag, everyone would soon salute. Like, oh, yes, that's the way things are.
Yeah. Goes back to what Haas said about personality, right? And that ties in with the crowd. Gustav Le Bon, those concepts of prestige just trick the normie into thinking that you have it because they equate a great personality with accomplishments, meritocracy. So feigning it and actually having it is the same thing. It has the same effect.
Right. It comes back to the Jewish powers of perception management. Yeah.
Davis, I want to mention over on Odyssey, Smiles in Court says, a horse and a donkey aren't the same species, but they create viable offspring. We call it a mule. And yes, there's a parallel there. Apes and monkeys aren't the same species, but they have offspring, and we call it niggers. So there's an equation there.
Yes. No, there truly is. That's something. Yeah.
He says that's a good, for the normies, you know, point out to them. The horse and the donkey and the mule.
Little treat for the normies. And then I suppose, again, I can't really, it hurts my brain to try to do this thing where, as you've said, the people who are mixing racially, they don't see it as unnatural. Right.
Yeah. So just like homos, same thing.
This is almost as difficult as, trying to see the world through the lens of the Eastern mind.
Right.
Because here we are like, yeah, of course you don't want to mix. And yet you're right. There are people who think there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, they're being given all the messages that say this is very likely a better thing than procreating with your own race.
Yeah.
That is wild. It's wild what can be done.
And Davis, our understanding, that would be you and me, is probably like a natural argument. So if we saw a white guy or a white man who said he was attracted to niggers, like negresses, for example, we would be thinking immediately, okay, this is unnatural. So somebody convinced him that this is what he should think. And we would be trying to get to the bottom of who manipulated him, who tricked him, who pushed him in this direction. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe there's just some strange, aberrant, thing that can't be explained with natural or unnatural, and he wasn't manipulated towards that, and I don't know what that would be. I don't know how to define it, so I won't say.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah, but again, we're going to ask him, like, bro, how how can you see this Nicki Minaj or something and not want to puke?
Yeah, I don't get it. So it comes back to the physiological thing where it's like, but of course this is so subjective, but when seen through your own eyes, their subjectivity doesn't really enter into your understanding. So yeah, you're looking at someone who finds that attractive, and I just don't get how you, to be crass, it's like, dude, how can you get a boner for a nog? I just don't get it. In fact, yeah. I argue it's not possible. In other words, if you call yourself a WN and you've gotten a boner for a nog, you might be in the wrong group, is what I'm saying. Suggesting.
Yes, it is a mystery.
It's truly a mystery, yeah. I don't get it.
Yep. I noticed the Serbian Bull's been real quiet since we started talking about this, so
maybe that's his dad.
Maybe we scared him off.
Serbian Bull likes the white ladies, yeah. Yeah. He says, have some support. Come on, guys, chip in some in there.
Serbian Bull.
Yeah, they're not listening, so.
Serbian Bull.
You're going to get the horns, motherfuckers.
Serbian Bull.
Serbian Bull.
There you go.
Serb says, pink is pink, and it's been a while.
That's no excuse, my man.
No, dude.
You're kidding. We know you're kidding.
That's you funny.
Yeah, that is funny. The problem is, it's not pink is pink. It's pink or purple Batwing.
It's bad. So, exactly.
Pink.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's funny. It's pink or stink is the real contrast. Mm-hmm. All right. Smiles in court. I'm not going to make a marriage joke. Nogulator, MFC NorCal.
Nogulator.
Right, tearing it up over here. Yeah. Nogulator.
Well, Davis, wow. I would be checking FTJ as well, but for some reason the chat's not showing up when I navigate to that page. So.
Oh, that's weird. I have the chat still. Last person was Andy Waffen with 20, unless it's not refreshing. Hold on. Me, bitty, me, refreshing, refreshing, refreshing. And... nope, still Annie Waffen being the last one with her question of our mind and soul one and the same then. And yeah, we'd say it depends if you're of an Eastern mind or a Western mind.
So yeah, that's true too. Answer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the support, everybody who did dono. That's awesome. I really appreciate it.
Yes, indeed. So any other final statements, Luke?
Nope. The next chapter... Chapter 8 focuses on the distinction between knowledge in the East and knowledge in the West. So that should be pretty interesting because Haas has already mentioned knowledge, but more specifically to the West. So we'll see what he has to say about the Eastern view. I'm curious.
Interesting. All right. I'm looking forward to it. Everyone else is as well. Let's do this.
I'm excited.
G-Man sent this. Anything you say <G-Man>. will be held against you. Tits.
Yeah, smart guy.
Right, see? I got you there. Well, there's That's worse good. Things to go to the stake for.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Till next time, Davis Lerman, Luke Notaris, signing off.
Oy vey. Such a podcast.
Yup, yuppers and fabulous.
This is the biggest shift rightward.
Best show ever.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States. It read, when certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind. In the public mind, label them Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact.
Is it over already? Well, that sucks. We can't do better than that. Nope.
Totally.
How do they do it?
Thanks so much.
We've just been on a run of really good shows lately.
Wow. Good job.
Yeah.
Extreme in every sense of the word.
It's premium content, inciting hate.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. You said it all.
Is it always this good?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you're a white male. You have to be white for this to count, okay?
Hey, you can't use that word. It's racist. They can call themselves that, but we can't.
I hate you niggers so much. Jews should not feel safe.
Full stop?
Jews should not feel safe.
The Jew problem.
Yeah. Sorry to go Jew mode on you guys. I apologize.
An explosion of Jew hatred.
Be, bye.